Welcome to the Independence by Design podcast, where we discuss what it means to be a business owner and ways to get unstuck from the day-to-day so we can design a business that gives us a life of independence. What's up, everybody? Very excited for today's episode. We are going to be diving into business valuations with Brandon Hall, the founder of BGH Valuations, and he has done almost 2,000 business valuations in 100 different industries, and he's going to be breaking down the three different methods of valuing a company, what he's looking for when valuing a business, and if you want to know more about him and the topic of today's conversation, check out the show notes. If you're new to the show, welcome, and I highly recommend going and checking out the first episode in the podcast players, which is episode 400. You'll hear a little bit more about me, the Independence by Design framework. And if you want any of the older episodes from my previous shows, those are all on my YouTube channel, which is Ryan Tansom. Thanks everybody for tuning in. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Brandon on business valuations. Brandon, I am so pumped.
Yes. We got it. We got it together. Round two.
I don't know when we met each other, but it was really fun just catching up. And, you know, we'll give Adam Webb the credit for saying, dude, you guys have... I'm like, oh my God, it's been like 5-6 years or so, whatever the hell it is since we connected.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, time flies. And the changes, and it's going to be fun to catch up. So yeah. Super cool. Super cool to be on, man.
So I'll put a container around this, and you and I can go wherever we want to go with this, like we did, we're just doing before we hit record. So what I'm excited about and why we had reconnected is you've been in the valuation space for a long time. You do a lot of valuations every year, and you can kind of correct me or go back into different avenues of this, but that with the SBA valuation, Brandon, why I thought this is so fascinating is that with the Independence by Design framework that I've been working on for so long, it's like, hey, if a business owner can cash flow their income through distributions while someone else is running their company, I mean, that's something to strive for. Not everybody can do it right away. But I'm like, you could always literally turn that into debt and have it on a 10-year AM schedule. And there's your valuation, essentially. And, you know, if you can prove that you can take that distribution, you could go to an SBA loan. You go get an SBA loan. You could have a... maybe your CEO who doesn't have the money, get an SBA loan. There's so many options that it opens up from that cash flow valuation. So I kept saying to everybody, like, think about how much debt you could service while everything else continues to work without throwing up in your mouth and times it by 120 months and there's your valuation. But like outside, so that's kind of container one. But then when you and I had caught up, you said that you had... really got into other valuations like estate planning, divorces, partnership buyouts. And so what kind of the context I want to put here, Brandon, is that there's the cash flow valuation that I just mentioned, and then there's the strategic valuation, but it's a positive or negative premium or discount based on the cash flow, depending on what the hell's going on. And I'm assuming you see a lot. So like, yeah, that's kind of the container I want to put around this. But, I don't know if you want to give a little bit of your background or if you want to make a comment about that and then jump in.
Yeah, no. All right. I'll give you a little brief background of, you know, who I am, where I'm at, and what I do. And you already kind of teed that up. One note that I just chuckled us is you laid it out so nicely that I might be out of a job now. The simple cash flow valuation.
I don't want to do all valuations, Adam.
No, just kidding. But in your point, and we'll get to that, it is. Like, you can make these valuations as complex as you want. And there's certain scenarios where it's needed, especially in the different spaces. But when you're looking at it from a cash flow perspective, from an SBA perspective, from an acquisition perspective, there's a keep it simple, stupid. Like, there's a common sense valuation that should be done. And I think that's what we'll get into. But so back up a little bit. That's what I do. We strictly do valuations. I started the company maybe 9 years now. We've been running full time and we cut our teeth on SBA valuations. That's like just the repetition of these small to medium sized businesses just going through these acquisitions and seeing their tax returns, their financials. You know, not everything's pretty, but like, it's just everything that's based off.
How many have you done over 9 years?
Oh, dude, that's a good question. And I really want, I did a presentation. This was probably, it was at the SBA conference 4 or 5 years ago already. And at that point, we were over 1,000.
Wow.
We had actually, no, no, we had over 100 different industries that we valued, and it was over 1,000 valuations. Now, we might be through 200-300 a year now. I don't know. I'd have That's to look insane. At it. Keeps growing, and you know, and my team has grown, and I got my brother who joined 2 years ago, 15-year CPA, had a lot of great experience. So it's great to bounce things off him. But so it's been good. It's been a good journey, and it's been a
How did you get into valuations? Like why? Like how did you? What led you to What led you to valuations and specifically SBA?
Yeah. So the straight up answer is I didn't like my job. Did not like my corporate job.
Love it.
Right. And it wasn't like this. I had this epiphany of, oh, I got to do evaluation work. It was like, what can I do that is not accounting work?
I was going to say public accountant is probably yes. the first.
Yeah, that's, and, you know, and we chat a little bit about
2,100 hours, dude. And like Crank you do this long enough and you could maybe not do this.
Yeah. And there's this, you know, it's like the rope of, hey, all these partners up at the top is like, hey, if you work 10, 15 years of mad hours, you might be able to get to my position. And I always remember thinking, 2 years into this, I'm like, I don't see me doing this. And we chatted about this before about we got juggling kids. I'm juggling, you know, health, fitness. Like I want to do everything, and this doesn't align with what you know what I want to do.
Independence of time, man. That's like one of the biggest things. It's like, what if you look at your calendar on a Sunday? How much control do you have over it?
And I was losing control. Let me tell you that. And everything was. It was just. You know, and you go through school, and you know, I went through. You know, I went to public accounting degree. You know, I double majored accounting and finance. I had the CPA route, you know, you got to get 150 credits. You go to public accounting. All that was mapped out for me. And that was just like, I didn't really think really why. It was just like, that's a good job, CPA, right? It's a dependable job.
Your parents are like, where did the finance lens come from?
Which parents? No. You know, I'm going to blame.
Was it just because it made sense? Like you like, sense. Oh, there's money. Okay.
It made sense. And I'll blame my older brother. He started the path.
Is he the one working for you now?
Yeah.
Ah, karma's a bitch.
Yeah. We joke about this, the full circle of like, now you're working for me, you know, like, no, but it's great. He was a couple of years ahead of me, three years ahead of me in this path. And I remember just seeing him and he was going through a similar stage as me. It's like, okay, you're getting married, you're getting kids. You know, we were all construction background, Ryan. So like I cut my That's teeth.
Right. I forgot that.
Yeah. When we might've chatted this in the early on, but where I cut my teeth was out there, you know, either roofing, construction, painting, framing. Like I was cruising around the U.S. and like that was, I knew that wasn't long-term like career.
Were you a storm chaser?
I was not a storm chaser. No, I did roofs in Arizona, believe it or not, which not a great idea.
Oh, 125 degrees.
Yeah. So that was a short period of my life where I'm like, not doing that. But, long story short, met my wife. Which I mean, I knew her from high school. I mean, we've been married 15 years, and we started this. We built this life together. And a few years in, I said, "Okay, I got to make like what's a reasonable plan to get out of this construction?" Oh, CPA. So that's where I went. I was 4 or 5 years into this, and I was burnt out already. I'm like, I don't want to put any more time into this. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was in real estate appraisals. We went to school together in St. Cloud. And he brought it up to me. He put the light bulb and he's like, "Hey, have you heard of these business evaluations?" He's like, "Dude, that there's a need out there." And I'm like, "Oh, really?" He's like, "Yeah, our firm gets, you know, we get approached that, you know, these banks need them." So I looked into it. And the thing about me is like, when I get an idea, like it consumes me. It consumes me and I got to figure out how to do it. So once I got that, you know, and I'm not an inventor or a bright guy where I got all these ideas, but if somebody gives me something, I'm gonna dive hard into it, and I go. So I just started doing everything on the side. I got certified in valuation, and then it was just I hit a road where I was working for Best Buy at the time. They found out I started a company on the side, which wasn't competing in anything what I was doing, but they were concerned about am I invested into.
So you went from accounting to Best Buy, or were you in accounting at Best Buy?
Yeah. Yep. So I made the jump from public to private. So I actually worked at Polaris. That's where I did get a little M&A experience. I got the taste where they were acquiring companies, you know, putting them in their distribution channels. I got the taste, but it was just kind of in the back of the head. I didn't really have any bright ideas how to pursue that. Then I went to Best Buy, followed my brother again. He was working there in the accounting finance. At the time, it was like, oh, better salary, right? Benefits. They had the campus. Horrible drive from where I was living, but And then I, you know, I, what happened was I'm going to thank my boss now, but he drove me nuts. it was the best thing for me. It was the best thing for me, but you know, great. Nothing wrong with her personally. She was great. And she just put, you know, we just didn't jive on how we do things. Right. And that's what I realized in corporate. It doesn't matter what company you work for. My experience would be completely different than my brother's experience. Whoever you report to really dictates.
That's your life.
That's your life, 100%. Yeah. So it's like, when you go work for a corporate company, I'm like, it doesn't matter. It's like, who to report to? That's going to really dictate your life and your progression. Because if they're not advocating for you in such a big company, you're not going to get noticed.
I think everybody listening in is chosen to eat glass for most of their life because of that reason right there.
Yes. So
when you go back to the valuations, Brandon, like what, when you say that the banks need them, and like, I think it'd be helpful to hear that the reason why banks need SBA valuations for the listeners, because like when, as a business owner, like, I mean, there's a lot of different types of SBAs, right? You know, you can get it for equipment, you can do all these different things, but like, what is it that the banks were needing and why have a third party, right? Yes. Versus like a bank doing a value, because like so many people are familiar with real estate, but I think it's such a fascinating space and how neat it is. And especially what I think we'll get to how it's evolved. And I'm actually really curious about the SBA loosening up, but why do the banks, why, like what was the need and what was the role that you were filling?
Great question. So digging into it, we realized, okay, so the SBA has this product where they're like, we can help these business owners, you know, or people get into being a business owner. And a lot of it, I think, was like, okay, at the time, hey, owner operator or somebody leaving corporate. And we have these businesses that cash flow, right? And it was a new concept of like, what, you know, they were so used to like real estate, hard asset, equipment, hard asset.
They being the banks, right?
The banks, right? Okay. So then now the SBA, the government says, hey, we'll guarantee a loan. But everybody was like, what's this goodwill? Like, what's this intangible value? And at first, banks were like, well, I can't, you know, we're so used to just financing off hard assets. And so the government said, all right, we're going to run a 7A loan where we're going to help guarantee this. And it's
financed. Is it 70% that they guarantee the loan, or what is it?
Used to be. It's changed.
COVID. And they're guaranteeing that to the bank. So the bank is on. Yes. So back to your point is like the bank says, okay, I don't have enough shit to personally guarantee. It's actually just a cash flow. So then they are hesitant. So then the government says, hey, we're willing to back you behind the scenes at what, do you know what?
It's changed between 70 and 90%. And don't quote me on this. I know I should know this off the top of my head.
It's okay.
I know in COVID area, they were-
Yeah, because it has changed a lot over the last few years as they've
been-
Few
years, it keeps changing and they got a lot of funding. And during COVID, it was insane terms. So they had, I think they guaranteed up 90%. There was no guarantee fee. So typically there's a guaranteed fee that gets, you know, rolled into your loan. They removed that, which saved, you know, somebody buying a business, no guarantee fee. Interest rates.
Wasn't like a few months of payments paid for too?
6 months.
Six months. Just insane.
Which
was like 5% down. We'll pay you for 6 months. Like, I mean,
you got 6 months of free working capital to get like figure this business out. And I remember talking to people like, man, if I, you know, I was like, I should just buy a business.
I was just going to say, why did you?
Free money. So that was the product they set up. And I think over the last 10 years, it's really grown and people have started to realize like, okay, this is an asset. This is, to me, more interesting than like a real estate is like you have this reoccurring cash flow. And trying to understand that was where we came in, right? Where I think the bank and the government and the buyer and seller all kind of wanted a third party to come in and make sure like, hey, there's so much room to fluctuate on what this price should be, where real estate and equipment's a little bit, I guess I shouldn't say, you know, there's appraisals and different methods on how they do it, but it was like, how do we protect ourselves from not having all these bad loans and then these bank, you know, these businesses going out of business and then it's just a bad
scenario. I'm tracking it because like, so let me see if I can regurgitate and if I'm on track. So banks say, we want to give some more loans. Obviously, they want to put money to work. They're like, okay, well, there's these cash flowing companies, transitions going on. We're not necessarily comfortable with just the free cash flow model. So then therefore, the government comes in and says, okay, we're willing to back some of that to get you, get the money moving. And who else? What other party? Because you're saying that there's a couple of these parties. So it's the banks, well, the government, so, and then so, then you come in to say, so essentially you're assessing the cash flow risk, right? I mean, that's what...
100%. I mean, that's, you nailed it, where when you look at a valuation, the easiest way to, and you know this, the easiest way to describe it is you got your cash flow and what's the risk? It's your equation. What's your, you know, cash flow that you can reasonably predict or historically prove that this business makes? And then what's the risk of this continuing? What's the risk associated with this cash flow? And that's your equation. And that's when you mentioned early on, and to make it even like back in the simpler, where you talked about is to work it as a 10-year term, like a debt service coverage of like, okay, does this make sense? Run the valuation up, you know, here's your monthly payments, your P&I, here's what the cash flow of the business makes. How much do you want to take in distributions and back into it? And that's a
right, and like it's exactly right, Brandon. Like what I've been saying to is like, there are literally three trade-offs. If you were to say, okay, I'm at point A right now and I want to go from right now to 2030 and I want my equity valuation, and it's the equity because it's the normalized EBITDA times the multiple and debt, like we could literally see distributions, reinvestment, and taxes and what's left over.
Yep.
You got working capital in there, but like, I mean, essentially you would be able to see, well, I grow too fast and I can't serve it. Like, but you have like the framework to pull the levers on this stuff.
Yeah. Which I think once you present that and get somebody to understand of how to look at it that way is brilliant, because it shows, like, you map it out. 10 years is your loan, making sure that, can I support this business with that? Cause I had a call with, you know, not to back get off track, but there's a lot of times where buyers and sellers will have a conversation with me and they're interested in buying a business, where before I was always I was always in the back end where the SBA says, here, bank says, do a valuation. We got everything teed up. Don't screw it up.
Well, the banker wants the loan. Everybody's ready to do this. And you come in.
I'm going to screw it up at the last.
I'm just like, I'm just picturing you with a wrench and just throwing it into the propeller of the plane. Yeah. Like, sorry, this doesn't work.
Guys, it doesn't cash flow. But no, and honestly, you know, how I like to look at it is, look, valuation's not black and white. It's a range of value. There's a lot of moving parts. And I always like to look at it in a range. And it's like, okay, you should be in this range. Now, for whatever reason, based off your circumstances, specifically the buyer and seller, maybe it justifies to be on that high range. The buyer is bringing a lot of stuff that he is super confident in, strong buyer. He's willing to pay that on that high end, right? And then the low end, maybe it's just a sweetheart deal where it's like, hey, it's an employee. It's a, you know, they're just giving it away. And it's
that
like,
range 20% up to down or like what?
Good question. I would, 20-25% is probably a good rule of thumb, you know, seeing where, okay, you find that median, that mean valuation. And then typically, let's say when I'm working with on a consulting side, I'll do a range of value and just kind of, you know, here. And you can back into it from a multiple standpoint of like, okay, I mean, if you're talking multiples, like, and I hate doing this because a lot of people say, hey, what is it, 4x, 3x, 5x? It's like, well, what are you multiplying? You know, and is that
multiplier? There are two numbers. Correct? It's the normalized EBITDA at times the multiple. It's the proxy for cash flow. But then that's why I love the debt service exercise, because it's like, if it's a professional services firm and the range is 4 to 6.
Yep.
Let's say it's $1 million in EBITDA. So you're $4 to $6 million valuation.
Yeah.
Run the cash flow forecast. You're like, shit, it can't cash flow $6 million at 9% interest. Like, it's not worth that then.
It's not worth it. Exactly. So and at the end of our report, we always run that model, that 10-year model. We run it a debt service coverage based off an SBA loan, a 10-year, you know, with the current interest rates. And then we usually do a normalized, you know, EBITDA. And then we say, okay, our normalized EBIT. And then we say, okay, what's your CapEx? What's your depreciation? Making sure that, hey, over the next 10 years on a yearly basis, what do you need to be investing this cash flow in? Like, okay, do you have equipment to replace? Because a lot of times buyers are not thinking about that. Like they're buying a business that they're looking at historic cash flows. And then we realize this seller has not made any improvements in the last 5 years. You're going to get hit with this. So factor that in, working cap needs and all that stuff. So anyways, you run that model and it just gives you the check. It doesn't work. You got to cover your debt. You're not cash flowing. And then
I agree. And I want to I'm going to tee up a couple of things, but I think I know where I want to start with this, Brandon, but I'm just going to give you a breadcrumb trail here. We're talking, like, here's how I think about like the bullseye. And then there's kind of like the other outer rings where like 80% of everybody talks about normalized EBITDA times the multiple. So yeah. Like that is not the ultimate judgment day necessarily, but like if we're going to be talking about the same shit, let's talk about what everybody talks about. Yeah. And then let's deviate from the norm. So it's like the equity valuation normalized EBITDA proxy for cash flow times the number of years of that cash flow based on the risk, which is the multiple, and then factor in net debt. So like that should get you your equity valuation. And then it's like, okay, well, at the end of the day, we're trying to get to that proxy for annual cash flow. And then the risk of that, but like why I love your, like the, what we're talking about is the cash flow has to be able to service the debt. So then you have to go, okay, there's all these different accounting terms. Like you said, EBIT, but then you're like looking at CapEx and Warren Buffett hates normalized EBITDA because of the CapEx and the working capital. And it's like, and I like I said, in every Vistage workshop or every one of my workshops, I'm like, fine, everyone, I get it. And I understand because at the end of the day, we have to service the freaking monthly debt for 10 years, hypothetically. Yeah. But like, a professional services firm is different than like, I've got an excavation business that I'm working with, $300,000 dump truck, right? Yeah, and then belly trucks, belly dumps. So it's like, they all So walk me kind of like with that kind of context, like how do you start to tweak? So that way we don't lose sight of it's too complicated. I don't want to think about this shit. Cause that's what I'm telling everybody, that it's not acceptable to do that. What we have to do is say normalized EBITDA times the multiple in debt is kind of the base case here. And then we kind of deviate from there. How sound is my thinking?
No, I think that's because if you look at it, like you said, there's a target, there's a range. And this is where, you know, mostly people are going to sit. And with that method, it works. And yes, you could have different debates and different discussions on what cash flow should be multiplying based off what business, and we can get into the weeds. But if you look at it from normalized EBITDA, we're going to make some assumptions, yes. But ideally, the normalization process gets you to where, like, what is this cash flow? What does it make? Hopefully the depreciation, there's some assumptions you make. Okay, you're factoring, you back out the depreciation and you're assuming that that's similar to CapEx. But at the end of the day, that should get you in the ballpark. That should get you.
Yeah, exactly.
And that should get, here's the thing. It's like, nobody has this oracle of like, I know the exact value of your business. It's like, no, like we're all just taking resources and getting to a point where it makes sense is where I should say, like,
well, and that's, what, when that's I say, the 10-year, but the oracle that we're trying to figure out, how do you think about this thought process? The oracle we're trying to figure out is how are you going to reinvest to continue to grow the equity valuation and cash flow? So what we're trying to do is saying like, you do all of these things and you're generating enough for distributions, taxes, debt, and equity growth. Like that's the base case. But then we have the oracle that we're trying to solve for is like sitting down and having a thoughtful conversation and planning to say, next year, Brandon, how many dump trucks do we need to buy?
Yes.
Should we lease them? Should we buy them? Yep. Should we do a combo? And so like you're just going through the resource planning.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, is it?
Yep. But that's where I think when we not to keep going back and beating the dead horse here, but like that's
beat it, beat it to death. It's already dead, but beat it again.
but that's where the 10-year, like that, I like that because it's like, okay, here, if you're going to finance this out for 10 years, we know all those inputs. We can look historically, we can look at where you're at. You can run, and like, it's just, okay, how much do you need to, how much you want to make a year, how much you can be pulling out. And then you can start fine tuning that, where to invest and all those things year over year. But that should create your model of what it's worth,
right? And you have to pay your taxes and you have to pay your debt. And you know what's so fascinating, Brandon? Why I freaking love this philosophy is like every owner listening to this should have that discipline about their own self. 100%. Like, why wait till Wells Fargo is sitting there with a gun to your head for 10 years instead of doing it yourself to say, hey, I need $25,000 a month in distributions to make this worth it to me. And then all of the resource planning should go around and after the owner's goals.
That's what I like so much what you're doing is having those conversations and educating and getting these business owners to think like that now. And like, why, I mean, I get it. You got into this business. Maybe there's different reasons why. Maybe you have a technical background. You get in.
Just like you, they didn't want to have a job.
They didn't want to have a job. And it's like, okay, well, let's make sure you just didn't swap job for job. You just, you know, right. You're, you know, where that's the biggest issue, where it's like, okay, it started off as an exciting thing. You're starting your own, but then you start checking the boxes of like, okay, are you doing the things you want to do? Are you making the money that you want to make? Are you spending the time that you want to spend on, of all the reasons why maybe you left your corporate job? And it's like, if you have that, and then it's like, do you have like a exit plan, or do you know what your business is worth? Like, all those things should be having conversations about, you know, what you're doing, I think, makes so much sense. Now that I've been doing, you know, these cash flow valuations, you know, for the last 8-9 years, it starts to like, oh, clicks. Like, okay, this is a perfect way to tee it up and to get them to think in this way.
I want to talk about how you assess cash flow risk. But before we get there, Brandon, I think it would be helpful to layer on a couple more, just acknowledging that people thinking about, well, okay, it's not necessarily cash flow for me or whatever it is. It's like, okay, here's a couple of the deviations from the norm that might be worth at least making a comment about. One is that if a company has more stuff that's assets on their balance sheet, yep, then the cash flow valuation, that's one. And then maybe we can kind of talk about the strategic.
Yeah.
But like, how would you look at the book value versus the cash flow valuation?
Let's say if I'm looking at a business, we run through three methods. You know, there's the income is pretty much what we're normalizing the EBITDA, normalizing the cash flow, and then we're developing a cap rate or risk rate, you know, risk associated with that to determine a valuation. That's one method we do.
And so income, and I love how you say cap rate, because I actually, in the workshop, Brandon, explained weighted average cost of capital. And it's the build-up methodology. But I literally, after I explain it and people are going, I think I get it. I'm like, it's literally the exact same thing as a cap rate in real estate, but we're just calling it the weighted average capital. And then we just do one divided by that is the multiple. And people are like,
So this is why I like to say that, because if you break it down to real estate terms where it's a little bit maybe easier, is a cap rate, right? And I always say, look at those real estate cap rates. They're always a lot lower because of the predictability of your rents. Typically, it's straightforward of like, here's my building, here's my rents, here's my cap rate, that's my valuation.
Anchor tenant, here are the contracts, here's a good spot in the neighborhood. Yep.
So those, you can apply that same thing to businesses. It's just you're going to have a higher cap rate because of the risk associated with that cash flow. But I always think, you know, you're saying,
by the way, just as a comment, is like real estate is we're just talking asset classes here, because real estate is a lower risk asset class than private equity, which is what we're talking about.
So if you go, and I know you mentioned the buildup, explains that. You start with the most treasury bonds, you know, you start with the most risk free, you know,
hypothetically.
we can get a whole different.
I had to do it.
That might be changing, but no. We're getting a whole debate, but that's the theory of the buildup, right? Is we're stacking on different investment classes to get to our private equity, our private companies.
And that's the definition of a house of cards, when the first block is in theory. No,
it falls, we're all screwed. No, but
yeah, okay. Well, moving on. No,
let's not. I'm gonna go down a black hole here, Ryan. And
yeah, I love the black holes, dude. What you're saying is you're just taking. And you're saying, okay, like, because what, Brandon, what I do in the workshops, I do is say, okay, let's say we have $1 million. I have to invest it for Brandon. I say, hey, we're putting it in treasury. It's 4.7. And you say, not enough. Then I say, we have to take more for more risk for more return. And you just go,
yep.
And you're just building up. And those first three in the buildup from the risk-free rate, the equities, and then the size premium are all published every year, right? Like, so you're not even making them up.
No. Thankfully, I'm not making them up. I don't know. I'm not smart enough. So I just take other people's work, right? And so, yeah, no, it's those are all things that are out there. There's a size premium. And then you can get into these different industry risk premium is another one where there's that's all published. The only thing that from an appraiser evaluation is the specific company risk premium.
Like, literally, I have like four slides in my workshop. It's like you and I haven't hung out for like years yet.
Yeah.
I just love it, Brandon. So you go, Treasury, it's a risk-free size premium because you're adding more risk in the equity markets. Yeah, then you said, okay, well, the smaller the company, the more risky it is. Yeah. Then there's the industry manufacturing.
Which I'm going to stop you there. There's another black hole.
I love it.
There's another black hole. There's a lot of people are saying, is that more riskier? The size, like, there's a theory around the size premium. Is smaller always more riskier than larger? And so I chuckle because
I was listening to a podcast. They were talking about the Google antitrust monopoly stuff, and it would be. Yes, like where it would actually be worth more if it was broken up in different parts. But like to your point, you're stacking those first three and then the industry where like manufacturing is different than SaaS because those are just different asset classes.
Yep.
But then you get to this line and so what I do, Brandon, is I have all of that buildup where we're building up the percentage return we need based on the risk that we're taking, which is that WACC, but the cap rate, as you called it. Yep. Then we get to this beautiful line, which is company-specific risk, which is the range is off the charts based on how well your company's run.
Yep.
All in the control of the owner.
It could be anywhere from when we're looking at a company that has literally zero, you know, or very low, on the low end of, you know, it's a type of business that...
What would be like, I've never heard of a zero, but like...
Well, I mean, a zero is challenging, but there's always some sort of risk. But one thing that you're trying to company specific risk premium is you're comparing that to others in that industry, right? So there should be already an industry risk premium. So you're trying to compare of like, why is this company riskier in its asset class? I guess in the company asset class of than its peers. So there's some businesses that are definitely in the lower end where the cash flow is very predictable. But there's still risk with, you know, concentration. So I mean, I'll give you a couple scenarios where the multiples seem to be higher based off the type of business. Mm-hmm. You know, one is a liquor store. Now, geographical, there's risk there because, you know, let's say if something happened, there's, you know, a Total Wine moves in and screws you. And but in theory, like you start mapping it out, the predictability of that cash flow is predictable. Humans are predictable. In times of good times and bad times, what do they like to do? So COVID kind of made that very challenging evaluation, but that's a whole nother conversation because everybody,
all restaurants. COVID made everything challenging for everybody.
Evaluations got so crazy during the COVID years because you're looking at these black swan event and you're like, is this cash flow either A, the business got, you know, maybe it was, you know, the industry got shut down.
Or a discount. Yeah.
100%. Where liquor stores got a premium. Huge premium.
Well, and then these people are stuck on a 10-year note, dude. I've personally had many conversations where they're like, yeah, dude, I bought this company then and this is what I paid. And I'm like, And then they're like, somewhat like literally one person called me that out of state, bought an HVAC business, came out of IT. It was like, wages have gone up 30%. My working capital and my inventory went up 30%. And then I can't find anybody. My customers are now cash strapped. And I was like, that freaking sucks, dude.
It does. Like,
they personally guaranteed your stock, all your retirement in your house.
In your house. Yeah. And that's one thing I want to note. Like, when people talk about SBA loans, they think like, oh, perfect. Like the government guarantees his loans. Like there's no risk. No, like you as a buyer, you're putting your equity, your house as collateral. There's risk to you as a buyer. So, you know, that's something just to think through. But there was definitely winners and losers, COVID.
Specific risk and how you're...
So that is usually a range of bucket where, I mean, we've seen some that are like startups, right? Those could be high, 15, 20. Like, I mean, those could be some very high company, you know, specific risk. However, typically that discount rate cap, you know, that buildup rate is getting applied to future cash flows, a DCF model, because there's no historical.
Do SBA loans aren't really doing that kind of stuff. Because like I was going to say, that's where, like when I walk through the capital matching, it's like you have VCs who are, it's an idea, and then you have full private equity buyouts, which are buying out cash flows. And then you have minority private equity, which is, you know, like taking more risk because they're not in control. Then you go down to then like literally it's like the banking world of SBA, you know, conventional line of credit, mezz financing. And like, so it kind of gives this whole spectrum of capital matching based on the risk profile of what the person's trying to accomplish.
And that's like when you understand that, that's the beauty of it, because then you're matching that up to whatever cash flow you're looking at. Where if you look at it from an idea, there's like there's like no support for that cash flow.
Have you just another small rabbit hole? Like the last 5 years, I've been just like, what in the absolute hell is going on out there? Cause like these, like, you know, you look at the public company markets and like the valuations and you're like, oh, nice. I have to wait 250 years for this to be returned.
It makes no sense at all. When you look at that and like
Nvidia, the valuation and like, even the smart people out there going like, they're going to have to deliver cash flows to the investors
at some point. At some point, it's like you're kicking the can down the road, and they're like, and some of these valuations at some of these companies that you're like, they got to pull something out that is insane, like. Otherwise, the current valuation makes no sense. So, but to your point, like that's kind of you could start there, which can really scratch your head. We don't go there because then it's like, oh man, valuation. What does that even mean? Because you got people in the public markets just being insane.
But that's the mania. And what I'm trying to do for everybody, Brandon, just everybody listening in, I'm trying to eliminate all of the noise, or at least help people make sense of the shit that's out there. That's really noise to say. Every day I have to wake up and I have to tell my employees where to go, what to do, how to allocate time and money and energy.
Yep.
And if you're an excavator or you're a nursing business or electrical contractor or an HVAC or whatever, like doing real things, delivering real value to real people where you generate a profit in return, these are the things that we can control, which is how well is your company run and where are you putting the investments to grow the value?
Yep. And that's where I think that's the market I play in. And that's the market I like to play in, because we've done a few of these ones where it's like, it's a patent or invention. And like you run into these DCF models. I'm like, at this point, we're just out.
We're all guessing.
We're just, I was like, at the end of the day, like this valuation doesn't really make sense. Next year, if something changes, this whole valuation is just BS. I mean, it's like, we're just making up stuff up in a theoretical world. Like if this happens, this is why it's valued. Now I get it. Like,
I can't even imagine how many stories you got, because I got so many too from people. But like, you're in it in the middle of the situation where everybody's trying to argue about what reality is.
So imagine that. So that's why I love SBA. I like, you know, SBA valuation, or even just working with your SMB businesses, where it's like you're working with a real owner that owns a company. He's trying to, you know, sell it, or he's trying to create a lifestyle. What makes sense, and that is where you can start, like, historically look at the business, look at the trends, like you can make sense of it. And that's what I like, because if you get into these other ones where it's just you got this valuation company running this DCF, you got this one running this DCF, at the end of the day they're millions apart. And it's
and we'll get into the purpose of the deal, but I want to close a couple loops before we get into the different purposes of this, because we're talking about the cash flow valuation. And again, the reason that we're talking about this is because someone can be running and owning their company, say, I want 25K a month in distributions. Here's what I need for this to be worth it. When can I hire a CEO so I can have an asset, take my step back? But like, all of this is associated with what we're talking about, which is the cash flow valuation. The buildup, what we're talking about is the WACC, kind of like the cap rate, which is just like the multiple, because it's one divided by the WACC is the multiple. Yep. But like, these are the things that we can control while we own the company. But there are certain things we won't know, which is like whether the purpose of the deal, the buyer and the seller, will drive it up or down.
Yep.
And I want to get to that in a second, Brandon. But like, one thing before, because, you know, a divorce versus a strategic buyer, all those things will change it. I want to hear your thoughts on that. But like, when someone has more stuff, like assets versus, like, let's say you do that whole discounted cash flow and you're doing the buildup and all that stuff, yet their shit is worth more than the cash flow valuation.
Yeah. Yep. No, and that's where, you know, this is perfect to get me back on track here, because I got stuck on income method and we haven't got to assets.
No, it's okay. We got the three methods to know, but I've got us. We're good.
Yep. So that's when we run this, we say, okay, here's your cash flow. And this is what your cash flow method is. But to your point, what if it's just a low, they don't make much money? And then you go look at their balance sheet and you start adjusting their assets of their, let's say, just their inventory. What's their inventory on hand? What's their machinery equipment? What's that value if you sold it, just liquidate it, or, you know, sold it to the market? And then you look at that and you say, well, that value is higher than the cash flow method, right? So then now you're trying to figure out why the disconnect. Why are you holding onto all these assets if it doesn't even cash flow?
Isn't that so fascinating when you start to think, like, That I think you just proposed the most beautiful question. Why are you holding on to all this stuff if it doesn't cash flow? Because if you really break it down from an investor's perspective, Brandon, I'm really trying to advocate for my clients and the people listening. Like, we're capital allocators if we want to get out of our job. That's really what we're trying to do. But if you got $1 million worth of shit, dump trucks, or you got skid loaders or whatever it is, and you're making 20 grand a year or whatever, you're going like, you're at a 2% return.
Sure. So here's the thing where it's beautiful how you set this up, because I had a conversation with this seller. We went toe-to-toe, and it's because my valuation came lower than what he wanted to sell for. And what he was saying, what he was trying to justify, he's like, hey, I make 100,000 a year, right? That was his cash flow. And he's like, that was distributions.
Okay.
And he then had 600,000, no, it was close. It was a lot higher. His dump trucks and equipment was. And he was saying, I'm timesing my cash flow or my distribution, my valuation. He did a cash flow method, and then he added on his assets.
Yeah. I've seen people do that all the time.
So like, many times. And you're like, yeah, how does that make sense? Yeah.
I want the cash flow and the balance sheet.
And the balance sheet.
It's double dipping to the most ridiculous extents.
And you don't realize how many people that are actually in the industry that are like financing loans
the valuation advisor was doing that?
No, like there's people that are like approving loans or there's a deal that is going through. The buyer and seller are both agreed to this valuation. And there's a bank that, you know, maybe doesn't do a lot of them, that's like, okay, yep, check the box. So it gets to me, and I'm looking, I'm like,
saying no to everybody.
Yeah. It's like, has anybody ran like a debt service coverage here? Like, how does this make sense? Like, and then like people add on inventory to their cash flow. It's like, how do you have this cash flow separate from your business assets? Like from the inventory? How do you attain this revenue without any equipment, without any inventory? It's like, that's baked in there, guys. Come on. Like, you need that inventory to have this cash flow. Now, goes back to your question. If the cash flow is low, why? Like,
that is the best question. And this will tie us into then the purpose of the deal, Brandon, but we have to think about the valuation in terms of the cash flow to understand the investment that we have, because you get $1 million worth of stuff. Why wouldn't you park it into the, like, U.S. Treasuries right now are 5.5%. Like, you're literally making more money instead of owning dump trucks and all that crap and employees and all that other shit.
All the stresses. All the other stresses in the business.
It's insane.
That's a beautiful way to look at it. It's like,
Well, it's the buildup methodology. Like, the people have determined, whether consciously or unconsciously, that I've got $1 million of equity into my equipment, making 2% instead of putting it into the S&P 500 or the treasury, which is the buildup methodology, which is what they should be doing every single quarter anyways.
Yep. And you presented that perfectly, because when I was talking with somebody and they were trying to justify the business, I said, well, why would I buy your business? I would buy your assets. I would liquidate them.
Because it's a cool job, Brandon.
That's why you're, how many employees you got, how many hours you're working.
70 hours a week. You never see your kids.
That's all. Sign me up. Yeah, that sounds great.
Can't wait.
Yeah, instead of just selling your equipment and putting it into the S&P. But that's a great way to put it, and like, have people think about that, because I think they hear so many different things on valuation and multiples and adding inventory and adding equipment, and it doesn't have to be that there's a simple way to do it.
Here's my take on it. And then I do want to get to then, how do we roll all these concepts forwards to when people are trying to do things and do deals or whatever. But I got a D in accounting, dude. Like, I was a copier sales rep, and here we are talking about this stuff.
Oh, dude, I could bring up my high school grades, math, you know.
I never got to algebra.
Well, I think I maxed out at geometry. I think
I don't even know.
pre-calc calculus, that was not, I didn't sign up for that. So, No, grades in school and accounting. That's funny how now it's like, now we're talking about all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, I was definitely
like,
not. Well,
freedom. Like, because like, if we don't know this stuff, then we can't get freedom over our time and get the cash flow and the equity that we want. So, I mean, if this is the matrix and this is how it works, then I need to understand how it works in order to get my freedom. And I think a lot of people, why I'm bringing that up is, my dad was a copier sales rep. I mean, I look at all my clients. It was the E-Myth. Like, I started because I saw an opportunity to get out from underneath it.
Yep.
And then out from underneath the woman or guy or whatever that's the boss and, like, do our own thing. And, like, all these concepts. I mean, business owners are already managing payables, receivables, inventory. And that's called the cash conversion cycle and working capital. But no one, you know, half the people don't know that. It's like, well, I know I can't pay payroll with inventory.
Yep.
So I just think that these words and these concepts, people inherently know, and it's easier to teach an owner operator this shit than it is to teach a CPA how to operate a business. No offense to CPAs. It's just different roles.
I 100% agree with you. 100% agree. All the stuff I'm talking about now and learning is after I've owned a business, after going through things and seeing things and like experiencing things. When I was a CPA, when I was running public accounting, I knew theory in these terms, but I didn't understand it. You know what I mean?
You didn't understand, like, hey, when the owner is sitting there and it's Thursday and $240,000 needs to be wired for payroll and there's $0 in the checking account, where do you find it?
Those are the stories that I like. Those are interesting. Not, you know, read it from a textbook. Come on. But
A through B, A through D. But like, okay, so going back to then rolling these concepts forward, Brandon, I think we covered the book value and asset value asset versus approach. The cash flow.
Yep, cash flow. Yeah,
so the asset approach, the income approach. Was that third one before we
market,
talk about like
that
the,
was market approach.
But. Market. Oh yeah, no, why don't you, okay, well, actually, that's just a different word for what I'm actually already saying. We got the income approach, the asset approach, and then the market approach, what I call the strategic valuation. And why I say that is because, like, when we sold our business, we had one offer that was twice the value of the other two because we gutted the company. But then, like, I also, so like what I explained when I had the strategic value, and maybe I just start using the market value too, but it's like the purpose of the deal is when a buyer and a seller come to the deal table and it's wrapped in what their intent is. Yep. And it's like, well, family offices gift their company to kids with estate planning. So they take that and they discount it, what, like 35%? And then they gift it to the kids.
Yep.
Or you could sell it for twice the value if you gut the company. But it starts at the reality that we've discussed.
Yes.
So like here are some of the things that I want to hear some of your stories about how that kind of mark all the different types of potential buy, and that I've categorized them into different buckets of buyers. So we don't have to get into that. But I think there's a couple challenges that I see is that if people aren't focusing on the cash flow valuation, you go through a partnership buyout and one partner wants to keep the business, but the asset value is higher than the cash flow valuation. You're going, crap, what do we do? Do we sell all the shit? We don't have a company anymore? Or do we discount? Like, so it starts to get so muddied up when they don't have a lot of choices because they haven't been focusing on that health of the cash flow. So like, how do you manage that when you have all these mismatches of expectations when you get to the deal tables?
Yeah. No, it can be challenging. And ideally, I think just hopefully more of these buyers or, you know, just owners are getting educated earlier on because they hear these things. And then by the time it gets to the table, it's like nobody ran like a simple calc here. And I know we've talked about that a lot, but like, and I will say, like, yes, like there's reasons why maybe a certain company has a higher multiple than the other company. That's just, at the end of the day, that's just risk. You know, there's like SaaS companies are very interesting. You know, for example, software as a service is some of these ones because it's like a subscription-based model and everybody talks about reoccurring revenue. And it's like, okay, like if you start to look at this, this could work because of once they have the software.
It's predictability of what? Did you ever hear the stat, Brandon, that Facebook took like 5,500 man hours to make and that's it?
Isn't that insane? Like,
and then you got like a, you know, manufacturer in order to scale, they're buying a $1.5 million tool die cutting machine every 18 months.
So you look at that and you're like, okay, this is where different multiples just means different risk, you know, associated with that cash flow. And that's where I think having conversations with different business owners. But for mainstream, for the most of the businesses that we're talking about, either it's a cleaning business, professional service, you know, I mean, you, there's all different types. There's
manufacturing, distribution,
retail. You can run this model, get it to like a normalized cash flow, do the 10-year, you know, do a build-up method. You should be able to get in this target. And I had a thought now before I lost it. And part of our process is, because let's say, you know, one of the things that we like to discuss is when you're selling a business, what is your owner involvement? Like, you know, like, okay, let's say if you have two businesses of the same industry, maybe they make the same revenue, but then you get to the bottom line and you say, owner A works 70 hours a week and he's proud of that. Owner B works 10 hours a week. And then you look at the cash flow, you're like, all right, the cash flow is the same, but owner B works a lot less. Sign me up for that. So that's a calc that you should adjust, normalize. And I'm sure that you've talked about this. Like,
but I think it's also interesting. I love how you teed that up, because even if they're both paying themselves $1.50, you should be normalizing it, like you were saying. But what's so dysfunctional, Brandon, and I am like, I despise the word exit planning, the two words actually, because no one even knows what the hell they mean. And it's like, because if someone says, even one of my best friends is, he's been listening to my shit for 10 years. He calls me because I think I might want out. I'm like, out of what? You know, it's job or asset. And he's like, oh, okay, fine. I'm sorry. So like, but like you go through that situation. Let's say they're both making $1 million in EBITDA. One's working 10%. One's working 100%. They're both paying themselves $1.50. Like the person that usually wants out of their job and all of it is the person slogging through. And the only way to sell is to actually transition your job, which is you should have done it anyways, and you're going to do it underneath someone else's ownership instead of yours. It's just so ridiculous.
Which we had this conversation, and the more I think about it, and now that you teed up like exit planning, it's like,
well, what is it? Do you know what it is? Tell me what it is. Do you know what it is?
Or it's like you talk to a business owner, and they're like, I want to exit. Okay, then what? Like,
what?
Yeah, what are you exiting? Like, what do you have? You know, and. So I love
dump trucks. I want to get rid of my dump trucks. Okay. Right. Well, and I want all my money and I don't want to work. And then like, yeah, it's.
Or how about this? Like you have it is like, figure out what your business is, figure out how to understand that cash flow, figure out what you can do to it. Maybe get it to a point where you can hire a CFO, hire somebody that you can replace some of the stuff you do, get it to
a GM. I believe if someone can run that cash flow statement forward and they can see what you're running, when you say simple calc, you're running just a cash flow statement going so you can see the debt service. But if they can translate to say, if you need $250,000 in distributions to maintain your income without working, can you do that now? Or is it 18 months? Because like effectively you need to be able to hire Brandon, your GM and CEO for $20,000 a month.
Yep.
Which is rich. So it's like you get, at the end of the day, people are probably 40 grand a month in between them and $40,000 a month in freedom, but they just have to run the plan. And then you can say, well, like, honestly, dude, like when I say like, we didn't go down the rabbit hole and then we're going to go back to then some of these other different deal structures, but I think that we're continuing to swim upstream here, which is fantastic, is I'm now having conversations with people to say, okay, dude, like you get $5 million. Shotgun or on the barrel of the shotgun at closing, where are you going to put that, Brandon? Because we got shit dollars that are getting devalued at 8% a year. Then you're going to go to treasury when they go, okay, well, I like people need to grow their assets at 12%, 8% debasement, 4% inflation. You need to grow at 12% to not lose purchasing power. So you go through that buildup methodology, which is just an investor profile, and you're literally full circle back into buying your own freaking cleaning company again.
And guess what? That's hilarious because I've seen that played out in real time. I have seen that played out in real time where I was this business owner, sold his business. It was like 6 years ago. He had this exit planning. I'm exiting my business. And I think it was like a couple of years ago, he went back into buying a cleaning business or something like that.
And then probably just put a CEO and do all the things that we're talking about right now.
Yep. So like
instead, like, yeah.
So I think that's a good way to think about it is, wait a minute, like, what are you going to do with that money? So I have this other client we're working with. They're selling their companies, and they're working through this model. And then you got something called tax problem. You know, like he hadn't thought about. He's just, I'm selling my business, and it's like, okay, what was your basis? You start running these calcs. It's like, all right, now you're going to get hit with taxes. unless you, you don't talk
asset versus stock. So you go through the whole thing and it's like 45 to 50%,
like the haircut. And then it's like, you know, these are things that if you're not planning for, and then you talked about like, okay, where are you going to put your money after? Like, so I get it. Like if there's a scenario where you're like, you have a great plan of like how you're going to live your life, freedom, you're satisfied, you're content. Great. I'm not going to say don't do it, but also I
think through it.
I love that. Think through it. Just think through it. Like, what are you, like, is it just, you're fed up and you're just pulling a plug, you know, have a knee jerk reaction because you just can't handle this business. Well, let's just back up. Maybe there's
What can't you handle, right? Yes. Is it the job? Is it the risk profile of the cash flow?
Yep.
Like what?
Yep.
It's the investor. Like that's why it's the investor ownership capital allocation role versus the job. Bifurcate those two, think through.
And that's why I love that theory. And I love that thought process. Because I think you could help so many business owners understand that. And it's like, okay, now you have a framework. Now you have something that it's like, okay, because, you know, back, not a rabbit hole, but I always chuckled at some, you know, some people, and I don't know if this was, if you were in this, but so no offense, but like
you can't offend me. It doesn't matter.
No, but I hear these consultants and they're like, they have this great plan of like, here's what you need to do. And then it's like, there was no framework of why. It was just like, oh, you need to do this, this, and this, and this to maximize the value of your business.
Oh, dude, I could go through all the shit and I'm probably certified under all of them. I mean, and I just think it's a bunch of shit. Like, Brandon, because at the end of the day, there's two things. We have a job, which is a W-2 paycheck that we get paid market wage for the time that we are trading for the wage, and then we are investors in assets.
Yes.
We happen to be both in the owner-operator dynamic. And so we have to be thinking through both of those things. Okay, with our money, do we want to reinvest back into the company?
Yes.
For what return, or do we want to take a distribution? There's a trade-off of that. And then how does that impact our equity valuation growth? And like any advisor, consultant, anybody giving, I mean, dude, I think we started this whole conversation before we hit record about how I think the healthcare system is the biggest dumpster fire on the planet. And I think the business advice system is probably second, because when my wife goes to the doctor and she's talking about her back and their degenerative disc, and they're like, we're gonna fuse it. And it's like, well, we're going to do this to your gut. We're going to do this. Yep. And it's like, it's one body. It's one system. Yep. And your company is one system. So to go in and say, put in an ERP system or hire this or do that or do this without the entire framework of, Brandon, you have cash flow and equity as an owner of assets, and then you've got a job. What do you want out of this stuff? How do we thread the needle of the system implementation or the acquisition or the product launch to more cash flow and equity growth? If people can't thread that needle, everybody's just guessing, dude.
It's guessing. And that's why I was going to mention, I like this because it's tactical. It makes sense. Like, you have valuation that you can run. You can run your what's your time worth? So what are you getting paid for that? Mm-hmm. And then your distributions, like that's your return. Like the investor, like I love that model because it makes, like, it's now you have something to work
with. It's reality, right? It's now just how it works.
And now you can start to play with those levers. You know, you can start to say, okay, like, all right, maybe you're working too much and you don't feel like, you know, your time, it's worth your time. Okay, how can you change that in this framework? Once you understand this
100%,
framework.
100%, dude. 100%. Yep.
I love that. Yeah.
This is why I like spending this much time on these concepts, because then let's throw in partnership, buyout, divorce, any of that other estate, shit is just a deviation of what we just talked about, right? So walk through, you can have the valuation swing way more with
but it all starts from the same.
What are your thoughts on that?
So and this is perfect because my valuation always starts at the same. We're looking at cash flow. Now, how that deviates from a partner dispute or bio or gifting or divorce is you establish the valuation of the business, and then it gets into these discounts and these premiums. And it's like, okay, this, you know, strategy that this business owner is doing, he's passing down shares of his company to his kids. He's now taking advantage of these discounts that are accepted. And, you know, there's some theory behind it because it's saying, well, look, I'm going to discount, 5% a year to my, my kid. Well, that 5% is worth a lot less than 5% of 100%, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. you don't have any control of the company. You can't, like, what if I go to the market and say, hey, who wants to buy 5% of this company? Well, it's going to be the marketability is a lot lower. So there's different things that you could do, tools that you can use. But at the end of the day, you're still starting with the same cash flow.
Well, valuation. Here's how I like to bring that up too. And this kind of ties in, and we're closing so many loops to here, which is so fun, is like that right there is estate planning.
Yes.
So like, there's no, like, because I've got this pie chart, Brandon, that I show. It's like you have your business, it's your net worth. You have your cash flow. So it's this pie chart that is like kicking out cash. Your cash flow comes from W-2 and distributions. And so essentially active income versus passive, and it's coming from your net worth. But like your business over here is the equity cash flow valuation that you and I have spent time talking around. If you choose to discount that and give it to your kids, fine. But like everyone at your company should get paid market wages for the shit that they're doing with their job. And then the estate planning should be handled separately. But the purpose of the deal would be the gifting, which would impact, like, same thing with real estate or any of that stuff. But it's like, what is exit planning? Because I literally say, like, do real estate investors exit plan? And people are like, what do you mean? I'm like, exactly. They buy good real estate, grow them, and then sell them in a tax advantage way when it makes sense.
Yes. That's a great way to put it. And like, that's why when we look at certain things where I have a business owner, it's like, hey, I'm going to do this valuation for estate planning. It's like, okay, great. Let's work through that. But it's like, that's not the same thing. Like if you go to the market, like, you know, like there's a lot of the same methods in there, but it's a different value at the end of the day. You're discounting.
Because there's a different purpose for that. And like what I see that is the most hairy situation. So two comments. One is that a strategic buyer will buy a company and then have all the synergies so you can get a premium, but it might impact your legacy and all that stuff. But like the hairiest situations are partnership buyouts or divorces, because no one understands this shit. And yet the company is going to still have to cash flow whatever the hell people agree on. Probably don't get paid enough money to go through those situations.
And we go, divorces are we do them, and we've done valuations. I've been on Stan, and that's a whole different realm. That's a whole different thing.
Can you send me a tape of one of those?
Please, no. No, I don't ever want to go back.
How do you describe it to people? Because like, let's say like, because of course, whoever's on what side, regardless of who it is, someone's going to want a premium and someone's going to want a discount. Yet at the end of the day, someone's got to cash flow that son of a bitch for 8 or 10 years, right? So like you're sitting there going like, it doesn't matter what both of you think.
And here's the challenging part is because we'll run into that where, you know, you run a valuation a company and let's say the owner operator. I mean, it could be husband or wife, but whatever the one that's running the business, really. The other party is saying, all right, we're splitting our assets. We're divorcing. I want half of that value of the business. And they pick up some whatever value they want. But to your point, it's still like you look at it like this business is going to die. It can't can't pay out half right now to you. Like it's going to be suffocated on the cash flow. So like those are things like that gets missed and all this. It just becomes a litigation battle and attorneys, you know, trying their tricks on stand. And sometimes I'm sitting there, I'm like trying to
I got a good one for you. I was doing a workshop and some business owner goes, I've never met an attorney that understands working capital. And I do have a couple, by the way, but it's out of a very, very short amount. But like, then therefore you have attorneys. And honestly, Brandon, I was on a call with a client, and that this partner of a huge law firm or a huge CPA firm got on.
Yeah,
and like, there was a valuation person because there was a partnership buyout. So partnership buyout, CPA of a very large firm partner, valuation advisor, and actually a friend of mine. So like I have zero monetary interest in other than my buddy getting what he wants. And he gets what's fair. And I get on and they're sitting there arguing about the valuation. I'm like, okay, wait a second. So normalized EBITDA was agreed upon. Okay, the multiple was agreed upon. I'm like, okay, so like we're like, what's the issue here? Well, working capital. The CPA says, well, we all know that working capital is more of an art than a science. Your face, the people listening, and like Brandon's face is exactly what you would have thought. And I was like, what the hell? And I'm like, it's literally a math equation.
It's math.
And then I know. And then I said, so then the valuation advisor was talking about like where he's coming up with his numbers. And I said, I'm like, dude, no disrespect, where does most of your revenue come from? What type of valuations? He's like, well, divorce is in estate planning. I was like, have you ever had to do a valuation where the company has to survive after this?
Yes.
And he's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, you have literally have no idea what you're doing.
And that's a great, great point. And that's one thing where I loved, like, I'm so thankful that I started with just actual transactions, understanding the market, what it reality is. Because in theory, when I went through certification, I talked to like different, there was rabbit holes after all these little different methods and how to, you know, this, you know,
move it this way, do that way.
Yeah. And it's like, dude, if I, you know, got out of, you know, whatever, started my business and specialized in estate or divorce, and that was it, I could totally see that where you're lost in the weeds and you're like, dude, did you ever try to understand of like how this would work? Like, how would this, you're so stuck on this method that you know, you're following. And it's like, it doesn't make sense.
It's like
sense.
The people dying on their, like, the, yeah, it's like, honestly, almost as ridiculous as people dying on their political party. It's like, there is a reality. Yeah. Like
you get back to that reality. And I think that's where, what we all, this whole thing, this whole conversation we talked about this, where, you know, you could say the oracle of understanding of this is like, once you understand that and you just make sure it's it, like, then you can start like, make sense.
The cash flow has to like, and going back to your talk, your points about some of the advisors and these different things too, is like, here's why I'm really excited for what I'm doing now, Brandon, is like, it's outcome driven. Either my clients will have more time back and more cash flow, or they won't. And it's either going to be their fault or my fault. And like, and I say that because like so many people make money off of the machine, just like the healthcare system where no one's responsible for the outcome. And Nassim Taleb, skin in the game. So like the strategic plan or the executive search firm and hire and comp plan or the ERP system implementation, if it doesn't generate more cash flow and equity while freeing up time, don't freaking
you can
do it.
100%. And that's where I love what you're doing. Like here's the great thing. It's come through probably trial and error experience, being out there.
Oh, it worked the first time.
This is a brilliant idea that you came up with and it worked the first time. No, like it's like you're going back and like, okay, like this is why, you know, all these different pieces, why, you know, I've come up with this framework in this way, independent by design. Like it's, I love that because I'm starting to get that, you know, after 8-9 years of looking at business after business after business, like you think, you go look at my early valuations, man, I would hate to pull them up because they probably didn't make sense.
You gotta get a stomach ache going, ooh.
This never comes up in like court, you know? I gotta defend this.
Well, I was a different person. So as we kind of slide into home here, a couple final questions for you. It's like, so you bought a bookkeeping business and I'm interested on that. And like, you have probably had a similar situation as me where like, dude, how many companies I've seen over the course of the last 7 to 10 years is a lot. I mean, I have had.
Well, you have had so many.
I've had more. I think about both of us, dude. Because a couple of the thoughts that I've had over the years, which has been hard to say no to, is raise a fund. I've got people like, here, if you raise a fund because you're finding the company, you got the deal flow. Like, so it was like, well, I have potential access to equity. I actually almost bought a garage door company back in 2020 before the whole world took a shit. Thank God I didn't. And like, but I sit there and go, okay, what has helped me avoid that stuff? Because it's flashy of like, look at the wealth potential, look at the freedom potential. But like, and it was this perpetual like, man, I don't think that could work. And so like, by understanding this, it's helped me like, who I love opportunities, dude. And I go like, I don't know, man.
I don't know if this is going to work. No.
How do you view that situation?
So I've gone through a journey. I hit a stage where 100%. There was so much stuff out there. And like this, what I'm trying to put it is like the flashy, like you're trying to grab on so many things because it's like, oh, this could make you money. This could make you money. Or this, you know, and it
especially when you're in the nucleus of the deal flow where money's coming in and out and opportunities.
And if you think in endless opportunities, right? And, you know, and I went through a stage where I was just like, okay, I got to do that, do this. And I, you know, I ended up buying the bookkeeping business, right? And that was, a whole story. That's like a whole story in itself in a whole podcast. It was just honestly like almost like a whim where it's like, oh, I'm seeing all these deals. You get this like FOMO.
100%.
these people are buying businesses and you know, maybe you hear about some success stories and you're like, oh, this is going to work.
And then those are the only ones on Twitter that you see, yes. Right? Everybody, acquisition entrepreneurs, seller financing.
Yep. Like this is the way to freedom. And I'm like, oh, perfect. So
I buy this. Sign me up.
I buy this thing on a whim. And I had no idea what I signed up myself for. Like, there was so much more work involved. Like, I didn't make a penny for probably 2-3 years. Didn't make a penny. I was
were you reinvesting your other business money into it?
Yes.
Horrible. So, like, when you say not make a penny, you mean like as in Brandon or as in that company didn't make a penny?
Both.
All right, pound it, brother. Now you've actually, amen to that.
So and this is where I love it because it's an experience, but it's made me kind of drill in of like, what do I want? What do I do? I have an existing business. Here's what it cash flows. Like, here's what my time is in that business. Like all the things we talked about. Here's how much I should get paid for my time. What is that? 20,000 a month, 15, like five, like whatever that is, whatever, like there's no special number. There's no like, but based off your lifestyle and what you want, like figure out that number. And then it's like, okay, what's the excess? What's my investment? Like how much am I making on this? And like, that's why this whole thing is awesome because I can see the reality of playing in my own life.
Well, like, and you and I, when we had talked, Brandon, I went the opposite of you where you decided not to scale up your valuation where you're adding payroll and all that stuff. And I decided to do that with my last venture. And then I'm like, growth is really expensive. And this is not really what I want. And
yes.
But it was like, oh, we hit these milestones and all this stuff. And I'm just sitting there going, I have to live and breathe what I'm doing. And like, it just was like, it wasn't right or wrong. It just has to be a conscious choice. And it's a fascinating experience, isn't it?
Isn't it? And I think these stories and these things that you talk about is perfect because one, I'm guessing there's people out there like going through it and they're like, man, is this worth it? Or you're not alone.
Right.
Like
that question right there.
There's a way through it. And it's just understanding like one, understanding what do you want out of your business? What are your strengths? What are your time? Like, cause bigger might not be better. And I did that. So in the book real quick, and I know, I don't want to run this longer than it needs to, but like the bookkeeping business, I had brilliant ideas. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to scale it. You know, you probably rubbed off on me. No. So,
oh, come on, man. You should have rubbed off on me. The osmosis went the wrong direction.
Yeah. So my valuation business was like, I finally got to a good like flow where I'm like, I love my flow. I love my, how much time I'm putting into it. My return, like it was good. I don't want to like mess that up. But I learned that because the bookkeeping business was like, I bought it and I started throwing employees into it. Like I hired 7 employees in 1 month. Horrible idea. It was a nightmare. And guess what happened? I laid off most of all those employees because it got so messy. And it was just like, this was not what I want to do. Like I became, babysitting and managing, and it was taken away from the stuff that I like to do. So what we did is we got lean. We ended up actually getting like, we were down to 4 and 4 good bookkeepers, managers. We have great clients that match us. And it's like, okay, this is where
this feels good
until something happens probably. And then I got to, who knows what I'll do with that, but
it's so good.
All right. Any closing things, any things that you feel like,
no, man, this has been, I'm super grateful for the time. And it was really fun that like, I know you and I caught up a little bit where I was telling you a little bit more about what I'm doing, but like, this was a fun conversation because we got some history together and like, it was fun to hear the difference is in our conversations between now and like, I mean, when you and I were sitting in that co-working place like 5 years ago, it's like, how are we going to conquer the world? And then we just ate shit for like 5 years, come back. We're like, hey, we both kind of found our thing, but it was definitely not an easy path.
You know, it's so cool, Ryan, is like, maybe it's different paths, different experiences, but like when I had that, when we were kind of reconnected and started having that conversation and sharing our experiences, it's like, we're kind of coming to like the same understanding in different ways. And it's like, oh yeah, that's,
it does not make, you know what it does to me, Brandon? It's like having this conversation was validating for me, even though like I've been out like speaking and doing all these things where a lot of people are looking at me like, yeah, like I know my shit, but like I'm learning every day too. And it was validating to me to hear you and I talking about the same things in the same way, because that means, because like what my passion is, Brandon, is first principle truths. And so if I have found these ways to describe these things and you are doing the same thing in a completely different parallel path, that means that these are universal truths, that it's not my opinion. It's just how it works.
It's how it works. And I think that's sweet because our paths are different, right? Like I'm more, I would say, a technical operator or whatever. And you have like, you're great at understanding the big picture and I was going to talk about our wives, you know, taking our ego down, but I'm going to bump it up and then I'll let your wife take it back down. But like articulate, like you, there's a gift, right? To be able to articulate all these different things and say, look, like nobody's perfect and we all have experience and stuff, but to be able to like take all these things and make sense of it, you know,
it's hard.
It's a hard thing to do, but I think you're doing a great job. So.
I appreciate the compliments, man. And you are going to be in my ownership accelerator with my owner operator clients. I'm excited for that.
Yes.
And if people wanted to reach out that are listening in and get your expertise on valuations or bookkeeping, what would be the best place to get in touch with you?
I would say email is typically really well, works well for me. So I don't know how.
We'll put in the show notes.
Okay, we drop a link, but yeah. You know, brandon.hall@bghvaluation.com is my email that I am managing every day. I got a website, bookkeeping business separate. It's got a separate website. Virtual Bookkeeping is the company. And then, of course, BGH Valuation is my valuation company.
We'll put those links in the show notes, man, so people can reach out.
I appreciate it. I'd love to have conversations with anybody out there looking for either services or having a conversation just to chat. Let me know. And then I'm super excited. Super excited, man, to just keep things rock and rolling. It's always a pleasure.
And it's fun too, is you and I are doing some work with Roger Roundy and Strategic Associates and my father, and mitigating some taxes and all this stuff is different game changer, man.
Dude, that's why I say it's so cool, is all these things like make sense. I was literally going through a valuation I've did for 3-4 years for this client. He's selling it. And he's like trying to work out this tax like issue. And then it's like, boom, Corey and Roger.
Because it's the difference between retirement or not, or like cash flowing or not. I mean, it's fun, man. I'm excited to get some of these advisors connected in the ecosystem, man. Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Appreciate it, Ryan. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Brandon. Go check out the BGH Valuation website. He's a great resource to better understand the cash flow valuation in your business. How is a bank and the future cash flow impacting your potential valuation? And if you're excited and you are geeking out on this topic, next week, I go way into the weeds with Ken Sanginario, who is the founder of the Value Opportunity Profile, where he's assessing company-specific risk and what you can do to grow your multiple. So we massively unpack where the multiple comes from, what weighted average cost of capital is, how to de-risk your cash flow and increase the multiple, and specifically where it comes from. And it's something that you can absolutely control. So thanks for tuning in for today's episode. If you enjoyed this, please give it a review on one of your favorite podcast platforms. It makes a big difference for me. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll hopefully see you next week.